If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale. Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Welcome to our new four-part mini-series, in which we'll be looking back at festive food from down the ages, from the fairly revolting to the downright delicious and sadly forgotten dishes that have graced our Christmas tables over the centuries. I'm joined in this culinary adventure by Annie Gray, food historian and the author of At Christmas We Feast, Festive Food Through the Ages. In today's episode, Annie guides us through festive feasting in the Victorian era, from turkey and trifle to creepy greetings cards and booze-soaked tipsy cakes. So now we have reached the Victorian era. The Victorians are often credited with inventing Christmas, so I'm excited about this. And we can talk about whether that's true or not. But before we do, what sums up Christmas spirit in the Victorian age?
Charity, I think, or the idea of charity, I would say. It's everywhere. It's not necessarily adhered to, but there is an idea that Christmas is a time when you think of those less fortunate than yourselves. And that is quite integral, certainly to the early Victorian Christmas. I would say it is slightly less integral to the late Victorian Christmas, which becomes more about a real family focus. But I would go with charity and family.
So a lot of people will think of Christmas and they will think of Christmas Carol, they'll think of Charles Dickens, Christmas trees, all these things which we credit the Victorians with a lot to do with Christmas. Is that fair?
No. Well, not the inventions. It is fair to credit them with popularising Christmas and making the modern Christmas that we have today. But a lot of that is about the way in which we think of Christmas rather than the practical stuff. So to take, for example, the Christmas tree, the Victorians are responsible for it in that I don't think we probably would have them otherwise because you can't really tell. But they did not invent them. They did not introduce them. So there was a Christmas trees were at Kew Palace and were within the royal family before the Victorian period because they were a German tradition. And in Germany, the idea of a tree at Christmas goes back a very long way. I mean, in Britain, we had the Yule log where we would bring in a log and we would set fire to it. But again, that's, we may have done it. We may not have done it, actually. But with trees, we know that there was one at Kew in, I think, 1808. We know that Queen Victoria had one growing up as a princess. There's rumours that German governesses had trees as well. German shopkeepers would have trees. So they were known. But what happened is that Queen Victoria loved her tree. And this was an era where sort of mass media was really taking off even more than it had done. And there was a kind of ferocious interest, especially in Queen Victoria. She really was this kind of media icon. And she and Albert knew how to use that. And they did use it. They were very, very good at using the media. And the kind of crux point, I suppose, with Christmas tree came in 1848 with the publication of a picture of them in the Illustrated London News around their tree, surrounded by their children. I mean, it's a total lie. You know, her mother was there who she hated. The kids were there who she didn't really like most of the time. Albert was a git most of the time. So, but it was a kind of in the vein of those really stylized Christmas photographs we get sent from people today where you look at them and think, oh, really? Really? And that was not what she was saying about him or whatever it was. And that picture of the tree, it's a fake tree as well. The branches are very uniform. There are kind of shelves on that tree. But it did go viral, really. And it kind of met a change in the zeitgeist, which was all about changing Christmas and putting a different emphasis on Christmas. And so that picture of that tree and the idea of trees hit this desire to reinvent Christmas, and the whole thing went mad. And within a decade, really, the 1850s went from no tree to universal trees. And it's insane how quickly that worked. And you really can see where it comes from in that period more than any other. So they didn't invent the tree. They didn't introduce the tree, but there's definitely a popularization of the tree. And the same is true of pretty much everything else that we try to associate with the Victorians as well.
And you said earlier that in the Victorian era, Christmas was increasingly promoted as a family-focused, a family-friendly event. So what did that mean in terms of celebrations? Was it the death knell for the trendy dinner parties that we saw in the Georgian era?
Oh, goodness, no. You still wanted a trendy dinner party. The children would be in bed by 8 o'clock. That's what nurseries are for. It differed by class a lot. So if you were upper class, you still wanted to hold big dinner parties, and a lot of your Christmas celebrations were still staged around large-scale meals. So the Christmas meal at this point is being held on Christmas Day, 8:30 in the evening. In the early period, it's very much like the Georgian meal. There's lots of things on the table at once. By the end of the period, we've moved to successional service a la Rus. So by then, the meal has changed a little bit. But it's still a show-off time. It's still when you have your friends over, your family. And it might well be a big occasion as well, still. If you're at that level of society, it's not really a nuclear family scenario. Slightly lower down the social scale, so you're talking sort of middle class, it is much more focused on family. And at that point, certainly towards the end of the Victorian era, you may well have your children with you. You've still got, if you're middle class, you'll still have a nurse, you'll still have a nanny or a nursemaid, but the children will be more involved than they had been. And when you go down to a working class level, again, you've got this kind of, certainly by the end of the era, there is this excitement about Christmas and this excitement about joining in. A lot of that, it's got to be said, is because of the growth of things like Christmas presents, the introduction of Father Christmas as a sort of iconic figure towards the end of the era, and this idea that if you're a child, you can go and stare into shop windows and you can sort of, you know, it's going to be really cool and you're going to get stuff. So it is an era where Christmas as a concept that can be attached to things really just explodes. So this is the era where we get Christmas pudding as opposed to plum pudding, Christmas cake as opposed to 12th cake, Christmas dinner, and also where some of the foods that previously were associated more widely with the season, such as turkey, become almost exclusive to Christmas. It is not that your Christmas dinner will always include turkey. It is that you will only eat turkey at Christmas.
Ah, I don't mean to dampen the festive spirits, but you do have an amazingly cynical quote in your book from George Bernard Shaw. I wonder if you could share that with us, because it did just make me laugh.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'm always keen to emphasise with Christmas is that it is not always a happy period of time for people. And today, of course, there are many people who are on their own or who have horrible domestic lives, and for whom Christmas is a period of real dread, actually. And also that there are lots of people who just hate Christmas. And they don't actually have a reason. They just hate Christmas. And there are loads of reasons for hating Christmas. And there have been many Christmas haters in the past. So if you are a Christmas hater, or even if you're just a Christmas slight disliker, or if you like to pretend you hate Christmas because it annoys your family, which I suspect is more to the point, then this is probably for you. So I'll read the paragraph. Despite the general fervour, there were dissenting voices. George Bernard Shaw, ever a cheery soul, fulminated regularly on the subject. "We must be gluttonous because it is Christmas. We must be drunken because it is Christmas. We must be insincerely generous. We must buy things that nobody wants and give them to people we don't like. We must go to absurd entertainments that make even our little children satirical. We must writhe under venal officiousness from legions of freebooters, all because it is Christmas. That is, because the mass of the population, including the all-powerful middle-class tradesmen, depend on a week of licence and brigandage, waste and intemperance to clear off its outstanding liabilities at the end of the year."
Probably quite a few listeners might recognise that voice of George Bernard Shaw.
I mean, he's not entirely wrong, is he? He does have a point that a lot of shopkeepers do make most of their profits in the weeks leading up to Christmas.
He would have hated the Black Friday sales.
Oh, do you know what? I hate the Black Friday sales. Those really are made up. But I think in terms of a wider point, actually, for those shops, and I'm thinking sort of booksellers and chocolatiers and things like that, who do look at Christmas as part of their business plan, we should be celebrating that and we should actually be spending our money, because do you know what? Otherwise we lose them.
So before we turn to the matter at hand of Christmas food, there's one final thing that I just wanted to give a shout out to of Victorian Christmases, which is the introduction of Christmas cards, because Victorian Christmas cards are amazingly weird, aren't they?
Oh, they're fantastic. I've used a Victorian Christmas card as the front cover of the book, because how could you not fall in love with a plum pudding with a knife sticking out of it and then children like buried in it? I mean, it's unutterably weird. I love Victorian Christmas cards. They first introduced in the 1840s and flopped. And actually the first Christmas card, which is by Henry Cole, shows a family gathered around a table with all of the children drinking alcohol. So it really does show the way in which, you know, children are welcome at Christmas and booze was fed to children. But there's scenes of charitable giving on either side as well, just safely out of the home. But they didn't really do very well in the 1840s, but they kind of rumbled on and then took off a lot really in the 60s and 70s, 1860s and 1870s. And then the Christmas Post gets mentioned for the first time around then as well. But those early Victorian Christmas cards are so worth seeking out. And I mean, honestly, every year I'm like, why has nobody reprinted these? I would have these. One of my favourites is two robins getting drunk on punch, and one of them has fallen over with its feet sticking up in the air, and there's a cat in the background coming to eat them. You've got oysters waving off their friends, and you've got kind of scarab beetles dancing with each other. There's even one which has got like people dressed up as rats. And honestly, toasting a rat over a fire. The Mary Evans Picture Library's got some really good examples of these. So if anybody does want to look for them, I would say knock yourselves out. Honestly, you will get lost in the wonderful world of Victorian Christmas cards. And then I'm afraid to say that a holly wreath or, you know, some vaguely non-denominational kind of Robin-y style thing in the snow, or a picture of your local town with some fake Photoshop snow on, will not cut the mustard. You'll be like, where are the bugs? Where's the cannibalism? Where are the completely inappropriate messages going on with legs and a top hat on my Christmas card?
Yeah, my own favourite, it has a man being wrestled to death by a polar bear on it, which is nothing says Christmas spirit like that.
I think there's a lot of death in Victorian Christmas cards, a lot of death. But you know what? Bring it on, because it raises a smile.
So let's turn to food now. What elements of the Victorian Christmas dinner would we recognise today?
We'd recognise a lot of them. So again, if you look at the wealthy people's Christmas dinner, you have nearly all of the elements that we have today. It's just they're not on their own. So meals were still a lot bigger if you were wealthy, partly because you tended to have a lot more people and partly because meals just were bigger. By the end of the era, you have sequential service. So you've got your soup, then your fish, then your main course, then your entrees, and you've got sort of nine courses being brought to you. But in those courses, you will almost certainly have turkey boiled, usually with celery sauce. You will still probably have beef. Certainly there will be a roast. You may have potatoes, you probably won't. Mince pies will certainly feature. Christmas pudding will be named as such. It was first named by Elizabeth Hammond, and then Eliza Acton followed suit in 1845. So Christmas pudding. Plum pudding still exists, and you do get both in books. And plum pudding is still eaten throughout the winter season, but you still have Christmas pudding. You will, by the end of the era, have Christmas cake. 12th cake dwindles throughout this period until really only Queen Victoria is still having it. And so it sort of becomes the Christmas cake. So you will see elements that are very, very familiar to us today. You will still also have ice cream. You may still also have jellies. You might have eclairs, things like that. But certainly turkeys, often with sausages and things like that, will appear. If you are poorer, you will have poultry still, but you'll probably have a goose. And again, this is familiar today, although today goose is a really upmarket thing to have and there's not a lot of meat on it, whereas back in the past, goose was the cheap option. So goose was very popular for those who were poorer. And you've also got things appearing like sprouts. So sprouts come in about 1830, so you may well have sprouts on your table. They're not obligatory. The range of foods eaten at Christmas is still very large, but there will be certain things. Mrs. Beaton talks about a turkey being virtually obligatory for the middle classes, although Nen doesn't actually put turkey on all of her menus. But there is certainly a feeling that there are dishes that we would recognise.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Hundreds of turkeys on sticks hanging up all over the walls, the roof, the windows. Then you'd have whole pigs, whole lambs, venison, game. I mean, just, you couldn't see the butcher shops for all of the meat hanging up outside. Still, in the case of turkeys, with their feathers on as well, so that you would pluck them in home.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
So do we know how it went from the ubiquitous beef and plum pudding to turkey being the mainstay?
Turkey wasn't yet completely the mainstay, I should just point out. Turkey wasn't universal really until after the war, partly because people didn't have ovens big enough to put turkey in, just as a purely practical thing. Turkey was popular when it first arrived because it was quite nice tasting and it was easy to prepare and it looked quite cool. You know, if you think about what a turkey looks like with its feathers, pretty funky. So one of the popular ways to present it in the Tudor era was to take the tail off, the wings off, and the head off with a bit of the sort of plumage from the breast, make the meat into a pie, and then put the head, wings, and tail on skewers back into the pie. So they would stick up and it would look like a sort of turkey with a pastry body. Kind of cool. And then gradually, as time went on, it became much more likely to be boiled. Celery, as I say, is one of the really popular ways to do it, or possibly roasted for some people. But roast turkey, kind of, certainly for the Victorians, roast turkey, it was sometimes there, but roast game was still much more prestigious if you were wealthy because it showed you could get access to game and game was, it was just more prestigious. But I think it had two things going for it. One thing was the fact that it tasted genuinely nice, much nicer than most modern turkeys because, it's like most modern chicken tastes pretty awful. Let's face it, there's no flavour. So a turkey tasted really good. It burnished up nicely. It had that skin that was really crispy. I mean, you know, a good roast turkey is an amazing thing, let's face it. It fed quite a lot of people as well. So the other thing it had going for it was the fact that it was big and spectacular and a big piece of meat on the table in an era where the majority of people couldn't afford meat still. But that said, you know, this is Christmas, this is hospitality. So the fact that it was big and the fact that it fed a lot of people was a really good thing in its favour as well, because all the other big birds tasted terrible. I mean, yeah, swan's fine, but I mean, goodness sake, it's expensive. You've got to get them on their assignat. You've got to feed them up. You've got to buy them from your specialist swan supplier. they're not easy to get hold of. They're quite tough, apparently. I haven't eaten it, but I know people who have. This one's just not on a par with a turkey, which you can farm properly, feed up. And by the end of the year, turkeys were huge at Christmas, mainly produced in Norfolk. And there are tales of, first of all, flocks of turkeys in the late Georgian period, then stagecoaches and then trains, just chock-a-block full of turkeys speeding down to London for the Christmas market. And there are pictures as well of these stagecoaches. And of course, butcher's shops hung. I mean, a butcher's shop at Christmas in the Victorian era, hundreds of turkeys on sticks hanging up all over the walls, the roof, the windows. Then you'd have whole pigs, whole lambs, venison, game. I mean, just, you couldn't see the butcher shops for all of the meat hanging up outside, still in the case of turkeys with their feathers on as well, so that you would pluck them in home. So it was a genuinely sort of phenomenal meat, and it really took off in the Victorian era.
And what kind of elements might we not recognise today? You've mentioned a couple of times celery sauce, which I don't think most people are having on their Christmas dinners at the moment.
No, we tend to roast our turkeys now because we now still have a roast, but it tends to be the same as the meat. So the turkey and the roast are the same thing. Whereas if you were wealthy in the Victorian era, you'd have so many different types of meat that it really wasn't. And because turkey was farmed, it lacked the prestige of a wild meat such as pheasant or woodcock or snipe or lark. So you would tend to boil it or poach it more correctly. And the celery sauce was just what you would do with it. I mean, celery and turkey, they do go quite nicely together.
So is that a creamy sauce or a watery sauce?
I think it's pretty much the usual. It's melted butter sauce with celery chopped into it. The British did lag behind with sauces, it's fair to say. The other elements that we would find slightly strange are there's a lot of variety around those things. And the roast potato had nowhere near achieved the kind of preeminence that today it is the single most common dish on a Christmas table, because of course it's vegetarian and vegan, and therefore it can appear on everybody's table, and it's a pretty sort of, it's not really a very controversial vegetable, really. So, or at least not in its modern context. You still have a lot of exotica on the table in terms of vegetables. You would also, your mince pies still had meat in, really, until the 1890s, a little bit of meat, not very much anymore. And you would still have a lot more things going on than we would imagine. And also, nobody really had brandy butter at that point, which is a good thing, obviously, because brandy butter is terrible. You would normally have your Christmas pudding with cream or wine sauce or custard. Brandy butter is a cold lump of nastiness, whereas custard is a glorious, eggy, vanilla-y, soft pillow of beauty.
What is the Victorian recipe, then, that you're going to champion for us?
So for the Victorian era, I'm going for tipsy cake, which in my mind is quite controversial because I hate trifle. It's one of my kind of undying dislikes. I think because I suffer from childhood trauma. Both my grandparents used to cook trifle, or make trifle, I should say. And it was the kind of classic 1970s, 1980s style sort of bought sponge cake, horrible fortified wine from the bargain basement at the back end of the co-op or other supermarket, and just tinned fruit. And I mean, you build it up, the whole thing texturally, it was horrific. And I really, really hate soggy cake. So with that build up, I wasn't going to talk about trifle in the book. And then everybody I know went, you have to talk about trifle. Trifle's a huge part of Christmas for people. Trifle says Christmas. And I was like, no, trifle's for all year round for those people who like it. And there was a fight and I lost. Because polls that I did on Twitter, I had a brilliant sort of time polling people on Twitter for sort of things like that, all suggested that actually I was the real minority here. So I thought, okay, I'll put a savoury trifle in, because some really good lobster trifles. And I was like, that's a gratin though, isn't it? It's not really a trifle. So do you know what? If I'm going to go for it, I'm going to really go for it. Let's go for the ultimate trifle, which is tipsy cake. And if you're going to do tipsy cake, it's really, really, it's ideally suited for someone who has a Savoy cake mould, but nobody in their right mind has a Savoy cake mould. They're the sort of fluted moulds that you get, which have a flat top. But you can, I think it looks best if you do it in a mould, but you could use like a Savarin mould or, you know, anything that's got a bit of fanciness to it. But equally, you could just do this in a cake tin, because by the time you eat it, you're not going to care anymore. So you make a fatless sponge, basic fatless sponge. You can put almonds in it if you want to. You don't have to, but you make this fatless sponge and then you let it go stale for a couple of days. So this is ideal if you're making a sponge cake anyway. So far, so fine, it's sponge cake. And then you soak it in a mixture of brandy and white wine. We had a lot of experimentation to get exactly the right proportion of brandy and white wine. I was drinking a lot of mixtures of brandy and white wine for a week, and I have to say it was an interesting week. So you sort of pierce the cake and you soak it in brandy and white wine. So it becomes soggy cake, but not sort of falling apart soggy cake, just cake imbibed with booze. And then if you're sort of early Victorian, all you do is pour a custard sauce around it and prick it with almonds. So you decorate it with almonds so it looks like a porcupine and custard. And that's the plain, easy, tipsy cake version. But there's no point really in doing that, because I think if you're a trifle person, one of the things you like is the visuals of a trifle and the sort of decorative potential. So I took a leaf out of a man called Theodore Garrett's book, and I went very over the top when I suggested decorating it. And when I made it, and it did look spectacular, I have to say, I went for sort of Angelica spears sticking out of it and glacé fruit piled around it. You've got to have your almonds. They look fantastic in it. But so it starts to look like a kind of weird Sputnik. And also you can take various jams and you can sort of decorate it with those, or strips of sort of, you know, the jelly style jam, the jam without bits in. You can add whipped cream, Ratifia biscuits. They're a bit good as well. You know, I mean, if you can think of it, then you might as well put it on and decorate it. And by the time you've done all of that, you can't really see the cake anymore. If you've done it in a Savoy cake mould, you do have a lot of height, which is really, really good. If you've just done it as a normal cake, by this point, you know, frankly, it should look like a sort of garland of fruit and nuts. And then when you eat it, it's like trifle in its purest form, in that it is a cake soaked with booze with whatever you've put with it. So it's kind of like deconstructed trifle. It was absolutely iconic in the Victorian era to have tipsy cake. And it's another one of those dishes which we just do not eat anymore at all.
It sounds absolutely fantastic to me.
It's pretty good. It's pretty, I mean, there's a bit of effort involved. And it's probably not a Christmas Day dish anymore because of the level of effort. You don't need extra hassle on Christmas Day. But I would say it's a kind of quite a good New Year's Eve dish, possibly, because of the booze, the cake, the rest of it.
Fantastic. And finally, I will ask you if you can take one element of the Victorian Christmas with you to 2021, what are you going to pick?
I'd go early Victorian and I would have 12th cake, which is sort of cheating because it's also very Georgian, but I'm not a huge fan of the Victorian Christmas. So I would take the 12th cake and I would take Queen Victoria's 12th cake from throughout her reign. She had incredible 12th cakes, which were sort of had kind of scenes on top of people picnicking and playing musical instruments and stuff. So I would end my Christmas with a 12th night celebration while knowing that, alack, it was the Victorians that did for it. So it would be an 1840s bit of Victoriana.
Why are you not that into Victorian Christmas?
I think partly because I've been Victorian at Christmas so many times when I used to work in costume, and it's one of those faux nostalgia things. There's so much concentration on the Victorians inventing Christmas and the Victorians having a Christmas which was very homogenous, and it wasn't. I mean, the Victorians did this themselves. So for the Victorians, they reinvented the Tudor period as this period of ye olde hospitality. And they also rewrote the Georgian period as one of sort of charitable giving and kind of, you know, cutesy old men with red cheeks and big fires. And they all claimed that in the 1840s, this is, people were claiming that we'd forgotten what Christmas was. And it wasn't quite true because we never had entirely. And Christmas changes and it should change. So I think my beef with the Victorians is partly they invented a Christmas and then tried to codify it. And I don't think codifying anything or making it rigid is very useful, especially not when it's a huge social ritual like Christmas, which is so varied or should be. And my second problem with it is this idea today that we revere the Victorians for having some form of proper Christmas, when actually the way in which it was celebrated was so different between classes, between individuals, between households, and where urban and rural poverty was still a huge, huge issue, and where people were literally starving. So the idea that we look upon the Victorians as cozy, and I think, you know, it's every costume drama going, isn't it? There's always snows at Christmas in the Victorian period. Part of me just goes, for goodness sake, it's all an oversimplification. Give me the Georgians. I might be a bit of a George Bernard Shaw.
That was Annie Gray. Her book, At Christmas We Feast, Festive Food from Down the Ages, is available now, published by Profile. Annie also wrote a feature on historical Christmas feasts for the Christmas issue of BBC History magazine, and that is on sale now. Next Saturday, we'll be back with more Christmas feasting as Annie and I look at Christmas food from the 20th century. From suspect dishes made under World War II rationing to joyful post-war creations coated in piped green mayonnaise. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.